Well, I'm going to try and do this. It's Sunday, June 18th, 2023. It's 15:38 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Is that true? Really? Let's check. See if I can check this. More accurately, there we go. Yeah, 15:38 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Ward Green with you. Let's begin with a song before we read the paragraphs 11E through G of Chapter 11 of Wild Road. This song is from a band called The Four Seasons. The song was released in, I'm going to get it right here. It's over here somewhere. Here we go. Right, okay. I know I could have taken a guess. I would have been close, but I would have been bang on. It was 1975 when this song was released. But the important, amazing thing about it was number one in Canada's RPM Top Singles chart, and also in the UK, and also on two of the US charts. The Billboard Top 100 and the Cashbox Top 100. And it did fairly well in some other places too. Let's include that idea. But it did well in a lot of places, so there's too many to mention there. But this was from 1975 by the Four Seasons, this song. Can you guess what it was? Well, it was called December 1963, or I'm going by memory alone here, but I know the song well. It meant a lot to me at that time and in my life at that time. The other name of the song is Oh, What a Night.
Now remember.
What a song. What a song. Now, that was sung by a gentleman by the name of Pulsey. Jerry Pulsey. And Frankie Valli, who's he was a famous singer before this band, seems to me. He's been around for a while. Frankie Valli, and also he was in the band singing backup, and also Tommy DeVito. He had been around in a band with Frankie Valli, I believe, too. So prior to this band, the Four Seasons, so it was a very accomplished band to start with. Trying to think who else was in it that we would know. Well, by the way, Tommy DeVito was the lead guitarist in that, and Frankie Valli was in the center singing the lead, not the lead vocals. It was part of the lead vocals, I suppose, but it was backup vocals, not the lead vocal. And the bass player also sang some of the important vocals in that song. Jerry Pulsey was the drummer and the lead singer, which is a little bit unusual. We know Phil Collins did that, and there were some other bands, like The Band did that also, where they had their drummer singing lead vocals at least, you know, part of the time, if not all the time, but usually not all the time for a drummer to do that. But the bass player was singing some of the vocals there, and they had a keyboard player, too. We're not going to, I guess, cover the entire band. Just Google them, but it takes some work to Google them and then track down the face in the video and put it to a name, because the band had different members at different times, of course. But that song from 1975, a pretty big hit. So in the Wild Road article today, Little Children, we've got a continuation of the discussion of Dido and how we know the dates of this period of history in Carthage, and also the Egyptian history of the time of Shoshank the First. Even with her husband's murder dated 887 BCE, she will possibly not have arrived in Carthage before 883 BCE, this being the date determined by Solanus for Carthage by the 737 years given by him as its entire duration, about 2 years before Aeneas in 881 BCE. And Dido might be dead by suicide from Virgil's Aeneid before she held an encomium dedication of Carthage December/January 870 BCE. One perhaps had better not rely on Virgil's history. The year of the Battle of Karkar in 900 BCE is not conflicting with Matan the First, and commends Pygmalion year 1 to 894, not 887, because Matan only ruled 9 years, while Pygmalion year 1, 894, also provides a motive in 887 BCE, 7 years later, for the murder of Sicarbas, as he was a priest or manzer, and Bali Manzer presented the Assyrian tribute year 18, Shalmaneser the Third. As Cinyras married Metharm, the daughter of Pygmalion, this offers further proof of the dating of the events, for 894 year 1 implies a 903 birth for Pygmalion, thus his age 7 years after Troy's fall in 881 is 22. So he might have a nubile daughter soon to bless Cinyras. In manifold ways, the dates are most truly sufficient, although they have to lack perfection of every source. After Pygmalion's 47-year reign, he died, thus in 847 BCE. But no names or dates of his immediate successors are yet given to confirm or contradict this, until now, it having been consistent with all of the Tyrian data. The founding of Carthage was 870 BCE, as given by many commentators, consistent with most recent radiocarbon dates so far obtained for Carthage's early beginnings. See our article, Crucible of Credible Creed, paragraph, chapter 9, paragraph 12, at the bottom. Do not buy any article as though we intend to promote a sale, for we hold information must be free. The expedition of Sesostris, or Sesonchus, was 9 years in duration and ended in year 14 of Rehoboam, when he is assumed to be the Shishak of the Holy Scriptures. This is significant because the year 14 of Rehoboam is about 964 BCE, and we believe that Shoshank I lived until 959 BCE, enough time to complete his campaign reliefs. Fascinating that it works so well in our chronology. The names of the kings of Egypt. Now, we made our chronology with the intent of making everything work. That was how it was done. The names of the kings of Egypt recorded by Herodotus, while perhaps conflated with earlier kings, correspond very well in time with the kings ruling after Shishak. Were this not indeed the case, we would not be able, or we would not be even able to begin the discussion of this very complex matter. Proteus of Herodotus is called, quote, a man of Memphis, end quote, and corresponds thus to Memnon, or Amenophis, of the BOS. That's another great correspondence. He is listed 59 years after Susakim, spelled E-I-M, compared to Susakim, spelled I-M, the spelling for Shishak in Brenton's translation in the Bible. So there's proof right there that Shoshank is in fact the Shishak of the Bible. Again, more proof, but this is something we didn't even mention before. And Susakim, Memnon, is beginning to rule in 934, exactly 518 years after the arrival of Israel to the walls of Jericho in 1452. These 518 years, in quotes, 518 years, are the same as given by Josephus in his account of Manetho regarding the time of Amenophis, who was, he says, the father of Ramesses, also called Sethos, whom Manetho appears to be confusing with Seti II, the son of Merneptah. Merneptah, Amenophis, Merneptah, Memnon, similar name, to whose review this hardly applies. Apparently, Manetho is telling the story of Seti I and Ramesses II regarding an interloper, although Seti was not the brother of either Ramesses I or Horemheb. Thus, the story of Aegyptus and Danaus that he assigns here to the time of Ramesses II is something belonging to a much later time period, evidently the time of Shoshank I, as the only fitting era of Egyptian military might. And that's the end of our study for today from this article. Little children, isn't it exceptional? I mean, we were humble. We tried to accommodate the facts. We weren't interested in warping anything or bending it or twisting it. We tried to accommodate the facts as they had been presented. Psalm 32, this is going to be our proverb for today. On this account, every loyal one will pray to you at such a time only as you may be found. That's all we need to take from this verse, Psalm 32 and 6. That's the scripture I was trying to remember yesterday. And 2 Corinthians 12 and 3, Jesus is Lord. Okay? But on this account, every loyal one will pray to you, talking about Jehovah. At such a time, when will they pray? At such a time only, as you may be found. That is the crucial thing. It's not prayer at any time that works. Although we can pray incessantly, but our prayer is only going to be heard if we pray at the right time. So we should pray incessantly, because we never know when that time will arrive. But it's the timing that's so crucial with prayers. That is a complete revelation, is it not? For many of us. Leviticus 18. And Jehovah continued to speak to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, and you must say to them, I am Jehovah your God. The way the land of Egypt does, in which you dwelt, you must not do. And the way the land of Canaan does, into which I am bringing you, you must not do. And in their statutes you must not walk. My judicial decisions you should carry out, and my statutes you should keep so as to walk in them. I am Jehovah your God, and you must keep my statutes and my judicial decisions, which if a man will do, he must also live by means of them. I am Jehovah. You people must not come near any man of you to any close fleshly relative of his to lay bare nakedness. I am Jehovah. The nakedness of your father and the nakedness of your mother you must not lay bare. She is your mother. You must not lay bare her nakedness. The nakedness of your father's wife you must not lay bare. It is your father's nakedness. As for the nakedness of your sister, the daughter of your father, or the daughter of your mother, whether born in the same household or born outside it, you must not lay bare their nakedness. So this is different from Abraham's time, because it was not forbidden at that time. As for the nakedness of the daughter of your son, or the daughter of your daughter, you must not lay bare their nakedness, because they are your nakedness. As for the nakedness of the daughter of your father's wife, the offspring of your father, she being your sister, you must not lay bare her nakedness. The nakedness of your father's sister you must not lay bare. She is the blood relation of your father. The nakedness of your mother's sister you must not lay bare, because she is a blood relation of your mother. The nakedness of your father's brother you must not lay bare. You must not come near his wife. She is your aunt. The nakedness of your daughter-in-law you must not lay bare. She is your son's wife. You must not lay her nakedness bare. The nakedness of your brother's wife you must not lay bare. It is your brother's nakedness. The nakedness of a woman and her daughter you must not lay bare. The daughter of her son and the daughter of her daughter you must not take in order to lay her nakedness bare. They are cases of blood relationship. It is loose conduct. And you must not take a woman in addition to her sister as a rival to uncover her nakedness, that is, besides her during her lifetime. And you must not come near a woman during the menstruation of her impurity to lay her nakedness bare. And you must not give your omission as semen to the wife of your associate to become unclean by it. And you must not allow the devoting of any of your offspring to Molech. You must not profane the name of your God that way. I am Jehovah. And you must not lie down with a male the same as you lie down with a woman. It is a detestable thing. And you must not give your omission to any beast to become unclean by it. And a woman should not stand before a beast to have connection with it. It is a violation of what is natural. Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things, because by all these things the nations whom I am sending out from before you have made themselves unclean. Consequently, the land is unclean, and I shall bring punishment for its error upon it, and the land will vomit its inhabitants out, and you yourselves must keep my statutes and my judicial decisions, and you must not do any of all these detestable things, whether a native or an alien resident who is residing as an alien in your midst. For all these detestable things the men of the land who were before you have done, so that the land is unclean. Then the land will not vomit you out for your dwelling, for your defiling it, the same way as it will certainly vomit the nations out who were before you. In case anyone does any of all these detestable things, then the souls doing them must be cut off from among their people. And you must keep your obligation to me not to carry on any of the detestable customs that have been carried on before you, that you may not make yourselves unclean by them. I am Jehovah your God. Now when we think of, that's the end of Leviticus 18, when we think of uncleanness or cleanness, why do we think that that was important? Was it not because the Israelites didn't know how to fight against disease? When they got an infection, they didn't have vitamin C. So these things are not relevant anymore. astonishingly so, to do with disease, to do with infection at least, just not relevant. But we still find great interest in reading about them and how important is cleanliness. Is a question that we know. I mean, I was taught to be very, very clean as a young boy. I was taught, I mean, my mother in particular had a terrible fear of germs, and everything had to be cleaned probably twice, or had to be laid down on a clean surface. Everything, nothing could be touched that was unclean before touching anything clean. It was all very, you know, strategically detailed in the approach. But so I've got the habits of cleanliness, but I'm learning as I get older that vitamin C solves all these issues, and this cleanliness idea is therefore wrong. It's just wrong. And Jehovah proceeded to say to Aaron, "You and your sons in the house of your father," this is Numbers 18 now, "You and your sons," Jehovah proceeded to say to Aaron, "you and your sons and the father," you and your sons, let's start again, little children. "And Jehovah proceeded to say to Aaron, you and your sons in the house of your father with you will answer for error against the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you will answer for error against your priesthood. And bring near also your brothers of the tribe of Levi, the clan of your father, with you, that they may be joined to you and may minister to you, to both you and your sons with you before the tent of the testimony. And they must keep their obligation to you and their obligation to the entire tent. Only to the utensils of the holy place and to the altar they must not come near, that they may not die, neither they nor you men." Itchy nose. "And they must be joined to you and must keep their obligation to the tent of meeting as respects all the service of the tent. And no stranger may come near to you men, and you must keep your obligation to the holy place and your obligation to the altar, that no further indignation may occur against the sons of Israel. And I, look, I have taken your brothers the Levites from among the sons of Israel as a gift to you, as those given to Jehovah to carry on the service of the tent of meeting. And you and your sons with you should safeguard your priesthood as regards every concern of the altar and as regards what is inside the curtain. And you men must render service. As a service of gift, I shall give your priesthood, and the stranger drawing near should be put to death." And Jehovah spoke further to Aaron, "As for me, look, I have given you the custody of the contributions made to me. Of all the holy things of the sons of Israel, I have given them to you and to your sons as a portion, as an allowance to time indefinite. This should become yours out of the most holy things, out of the offering made by fire, every offering of theirs, together with every grain offering of theirs, and every sin offering of theirs, and every guilt offering of theirs, which they will return to me. It is something most holy for you and for your sons. In a most holy place you should eat it. Every male should eat it. It should become something holy to you. And this belongs to you, the contribution of their gift, together with all the wave offerings of the sons of Israel. I have given them to you and your sons and your daughters with you as an allowance to time indefinite. Everyone clean in your house may eat it. All the best of the oil and all the best of the new wine and the grain, their first fruits, which they will give to Jehovah, I have given them to you. The first ripe fruits of all that is on their land, which they will bring to Jehovah, yours it should become. Everyone clean in your house may eat it. Every devoted thing in Israel should become yours. Everything opening the womb of every sort of flesh, which they will present to Jehovah among man and among beast, should become yours. However, you should without fail redeem the firstborn of mankind, and the firstborn of the unclean beast you should redeem, and with a redemption price for it from a month old onward you should redeem it, by the estimated value, 5 silver shekels by the shekel of the holy place. It is 20 gerahs. Only the firstborn bull or firstborn male lamb or firstborn goat you should not redeem. They are something holy. Their blood you should sprinkle upon the altar, and their fat you should make smoke as an offering made by fire for a restful odor to Jehovah. And their flesh should become yours, like the breast of the wave offering, and like the right leg it should become yours. All the holy contributions which the sons of Israel will contribute to Jehovah I have given to you and your sons and your daughters with you as an allowance to time indefinite. It is a covenant of salt to time indefinite before Jehovah for you and your offspring with you. And Jehovah went on to say to Aaron, in their land you will not have an inheritance, and no share will become yours in their midst. I am your share and your inheritance in the midst of the sons of Israel. And to the sons of Levi, look, I have given every tenth part in Israel as an inheritance in return for their service that they are carrying on, the service of the tent of meeting. And the sons of Israel should no more come near to the tent of meeting to incur sin so as to die. And the Levites themselves must carry on the service of the tent of meeting, and they are the ones who should answer for their error. It is a statute to time indefinite during your generations that in the midst of the sons of Israel they should not get possession of an inheritance. For the tenth part of the sons of Israel, which they will contribute to Jehovah as a contribution, I have given to the Levites as an inheritance. That is why I have said to them, in the midst of the sons of Israel, they should not get possession of an inheritance. Then Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, and you should speak to the Levites, and you must say to them, you will receive from the sons of Israel the tenth part that I have given to you from them for your inheritance, and you must contribute from it as a contribution to Jehovah a tenth part of the tenth part. And it must be reckoned to you as your contribution like the grain of the threshing floor and like the full produce of the wine or oil press. In this way, you yourselves also will contribute a contribution to Jehovah from all your tenth parts that you will receive from the sons of Israel, and from them you must give the contribution to Jehovah to Aaron the priest. From all the gifts to you, you will contribute every sort of contribution to Jehovah of the very best of it as some holy thing from them. And you must say to them, when you contribute the very best, when you contribute the best of them, then it will certainly be reckoned to the Levites as the produce of the threshing floor and as the produce of the wine or oil press. And you must eat it in every place, you and your household, because it is your wages in return for your service in the tent of meeting. And you must not incur sin for it when you contribute the best from them. And you must not profane the holy things of the sons of Israel that you may not die. That's the end of Numbers 18. So we've got a few minutes again at the end of the study, this being the end of our study for today, little children. I love you. I hope you enjoyed this study. We learn from this that we learn more about what which particular sacrifices were to be brought to the tent of meeting, which we studied yesterday in Leviticus 17, didn't we? So that's important that we happen to know this. I didn't plan this. I didn't consciously choose Numbers 18. It's just Jehovah chose it through whatever means he had, whether through my memory, subconscious, or otherwise. But he chose this one. And now we know better. That, and there's a footnote, I found out also, to the idea of bringing every slaughtered animal to the tent of meeting or to the tabernacle. In Leviticus 17, there's a if you click right-click on the verse, maybe we should go back and do that. If you right-click on that verse, Leviticus 17, maybe I can find it here. Right, here we go. Study guide. Right, the diet of Hebrews, it says, did not normally include a great deal of meat, but when a family wanted to slaughter a domestic animal for meat, they took the animal to the sanctuary. But of course, after they entered the promised land, perhaps they lived too far away from the temple to bring every animal that they slaughtered all the way to the temple before slaughtering it. So, in a way, this helps us understand quite a bit better what was meant by this idea. And then in Numbers 18, we see, it's just so fascinating, is it not? That we see that every firstborn thing had to be brought to Jehovah. And that and they were, particularly, they were the bull and the male lamb and the firstborn goat. They were something that needed to be brought to Jehovah and to be sacrificed. This was the old covenant, the law of Moses. They actually slaughtered animals as sacrifices to Jehovah before the sacrifice of Christ. The ransom for Adam replaced all of those. So these sacrifices were a prefiguring of the eventual ransom sacrifice that would pay for the sin of Adam, which was Jesus Christ. He was the Lamb of God, he's also called. And Jehovah was using these animal sacrifices, which he gave as commands to Moses to be obeyed by the Israelites. He was using those as a way of prefiguring the Messiah, that who would come to fulfill all of these offerings, which could never fulfill the sacrifice of a perfect man, or could never fulfill the sin, the payment of the sin of Adam. But they were intimating that this was coming. That was the meaning of these sacrifices. They must have been very, very onerous to be having to sacrifice these animals continually. But that was the law at that time for the Israelites. So we have a little more to do here, not much. What did I want to talk about today? I realized some things. Yeah, I mean, I don't know which tidbit to select, but bed bugs live in a mattress particularly. So I think I found the mattress when I covered both mattresses with, I bought a queen sized cover that fits both of my mattresses together, which are slightly larger than queen size, but not as deep. The total is 64 inches wide, and the queen size is 60 inches, but because the queen size was 15 inches deep, and my mattress is 8 inches deep, both of them, so they were able to squeeze into this smaller cover, actually, but deeper. But when I got them sealed up, I haven't experienced any more bites, so the bed bugs were living in the mattress that I didn't have covered, because I had the other single one. One of them covered already with a waterproof cover. So I think the bed bugs were probably coming from the bed I wasn't even using. They just hide in the mattress and then they come out to bite you. That's all it is. So it's not got to do with, well, it's got to do with the dead skin that eventually accumulates. But I've got a very good vacuum cleaner that was, and the company that sold the vacuum trained me all about this. So I knew how to do it, but I had to figure it out first. This is June 18th, 2023, 1611 hours Eastern Daylight Time, Ward Green. And for me, it's Moppy and Hammy the Crow saying bye for now.